At the very outset of this talk, speaking about HaGaon Reb Yitzchok Yaakov Reines of blessed memory, I'm going to do something that is different than an ordinary preparation of a lecture or of a talk. What do I mean? Generally, at the end of a talk, we try to make a summation of the person's contribution to whatever movement he was involved, whatever he accomplished, and to try to describe the specific elements of his personality. And here we're dealing with a great magisterial rabbinic master. And I'm quite sure that if you were to go to the ranks of many people in religious Zionists, they wouldn't have too much knowledge about Rav Reines of blessed memory. But at the very outset, what I'm going to translate a statement describing who Rav Reines was in his younger years when he was a son-in-law of a rabbinic decisor well known in Europe. There was a Rav called Rav Yosef Reisen of blessed memory. He was a Rav of Telz. He was the Rav of Slonim, of many of these Lithuanian or Polish-Lithuanian cities. He wrote many Sforim, and one of his Sforim was the Shilas and Tshuvas Edus B'Yosef, of Yosef Reisen. That was his name. So in his introduction, which is our Shilas and Tshuvas, which are responsa in many areas of Jewish law, he has there an acknowledgement to his son-in-law. And who is his son-in-law? And I'm going to read it and translate it to the best of my ability. There you see who his son-in-law. This was Sefer was published in the 1870s. Rav Reines himself was born in 1839. And he passed away in 1915. It's 100 years after his passing. It's a centenary of his, what I call his Yahrzeit. But then his father-in-law writes in a long introduction, but he has a paragraph. He says, "Velo erdal milavorach." I'm not going to restrain myself from blessing Gamis Chasoni Hayokar, my dear son-in-law, Harav Hagon Chori Fubaki, which is titles, great rabbinic titles to an outstanding rabbinic master. He says, and he calls him Kliel Hamada. In other words, he has a totality of Mada, which seems to mean other sciences, other knowledges, like we talk about Torah Mada. V'Rav Atmuna, a man of great understanding. And Mechudod Umafulpo Al Derech Ha'emes. He is very sharp. He is very, we say, deep, Umafulpo, and Talmudically contentious, which is a great degree of pride. And we describe somebody like that. And who is this person? Moreno Arav Yitzchok Yaakov Reines of Bezen, who was then already a Rav in this little shtetl in Litta called Shukyan. That was the name, Shukyan. Asher Berechav Binoso, with the great width, the wide areas of his understanding, over Al Kol Pnei Chiburzeh. He went through my whole sefer. He looked over my whole sefer, and what did he do? Lesago, he organized it. The father-in-law didn't know, he did it. He, in other words, he was like his editor. Ulhamidu al nochem lahovi lebeis hadfus, to bring it properly to the publisher, to the printer. Av gam heishiv hagos gos nechayin. He also added some very proper notes, rabbinic notes on it, comments. Abki Achma, though they're very few, Avol Me'ilos V'Tovas Heine, they're very good and they're very beneficial. And Gam Zroya Sichlo, he describes the extent of his intellect, is Netuya Od, is still stretched forth Lehokim Edus B'Yakov. He gives him a praise. His sefer, the father-in-law, was called Yosef, Edus B'Yosef. He says, as if to predict, is going to be a testimony to the name of Yaakov, because they probably mostly called him Yaakov, Yitzchok Yaakov Reines. That's the Af losum Torah b'Yisrael, and he will spread Torah in Israel. So it's very important to emphasize this in the beginning, because Rav Reines was not just some sort of a Zionist leader, a person that was a nice orator, a magid, because there were in Jewish history, and even some that came to America, that were great preachers, preachers of the movement, of the tenua, of generally of Zionism, of general Zionism, all types of orators and speakers. Many of the founders of political Zionism were great speakers and all, but none had this type of substance of learning, that he was not just an ordinary Rav and a shtetl in Europe. He is called by contemporaries who recognized him as a gaon. Even Reb Chaim Soloveitchik Zal, the famous Briska Rav, Reb Chaim, the grandfather of Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, in the yeshiva world, the Torah of Reb Chaim, all you have to say is Reb Chaim, you think of Reb Chaim of Brisk, the Rosh Yeshiva originally of Volozhin, where Rav Reines learned. He was on a Talmidim of the Volozhin Yeshiva. So when anybody, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was very much against Zionism, he was anti-Zionist, that's a known fact. They would not support the Zionist movement, as many other of the famous Rabbonim, especially Lithuania and other parts of Russian Poland or Galicia, wherever they were. The only exceptional ones that were. So when somebody tried to tell him that Rav Reines was, he tried to belittle him, he wouldn't hear of it. He would not allow any bad mouthing or gossip in a degrading way about Rav. He respected the Ge'enus, the learning of Rav Reines. That's the most interesting point. So I start that out, so you should understand we're speaking of a person who was the founder of Mizrahi, which we'll come to. Now, just briefly, short biography of Rav Reines' involvement, how he came to be a what we call a religious Zionist leader and a unique Torah personality in that particular area. It's important he remember he was born in part of what would be today Belarus, in the town and city of Karlin, and the name Reines is really from a woman's name. There was a lady in his family that was named Reina. That's an old Yiddish name, and when they used to talk about children, they used to say Reines is a kind or something, so it became a family name. That's how these many of these names developed into that particular name, like the Marshaw, the great rabbinic commentary from the 17th century on the entire Talmud. So he had a name, Shmuel Edels. What is Edels? There's a Yiddish name for a woman, Edel. It was after his grandmother who helped raise him, so it became like a family name. Edels, a lot of these names, so that's where the name Reines comes. I'll tell you an interesting thought of I call it like a sort of coincidence, and goes in different directions. When I was entered the yeshiva, yeshiva's Reb Yitzchak Ochanan in the early 40s, in 1942, a long time ago, so the first Rebbe that I had was a very pronounced religious Zionist, Rav Aaron David Burak, Zecheinu Levracha, who was a great Yiddish orator, a Groyser Redner. He could powerful speaker, and he was a Rav in Brooklyn. He was a Telz Talmud. He came from Telz, but he had this very big congregation, what today is in Bedford-Stuyvesant area, where all the blacks are. But at that time was a large Jewish community. He had that shul. He was a prestigious Rav. So in our class at that time, there's a fellow that came from Paterson, New Jersey. He took the bus from Paterson and came over the George Washington Bridge to be part of the yeshiva. He was in Rav Burak's class. His name was Alvin Reines. So Rav Burak used to, all the time, we used to call upon him, used to, in Yiddish, say, Nu zo Reines zogen. He seemed to have a favorite feeling. He was not related to the family of Rav Reines. But why do I mention that? Because later on, this fellow disappeared from yeshiva. He went to the Hebrew Union College of Reform in Cincinnati, and he became one of their foremost so-called religious philosophers, Professor Alvin Reines. as far as rabbinic learning was concerned, it was a total amoretz. But the shocking thing is that later on, when years ago there was this Look magazine that had an article about the vanishing American Jew, and they spoke about orthodoxy and about reform. So what they do is, the reporters don't know substance of people. Here they have the Gaon Reb Yosef Ber Soloveitchik Zal, the Rav, a great leader, and, you know, extraordinary genius. They present him as an orthodox spokesman, and Alvin Reines is the philosopher, as if to say, opposed to the Rav. You know, it was ridiculous when you read it. But I'm just saying that was an interesting coincidence, because Rav Burak was totally familiar with the history about Rav Reines. He was himself a Mizrahi. The yeshiva, Rav Yitzchak Ochanan, was really politically religious Zionist. The Beis Medrash Lemeirim was founded by Reb Meir Barlin, the son of the Netziv. He created that. He was the principal of that. And later on, the yeshiva celebrated Balfour Day. When I was there, they celebrated Balfour Day. We had an assembly. And who do you think was the guest speaker? He was introduced as a fairly young rabbi from the village of Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is not a village, it always was a large city, because I come from Newark, which is much larger. And what was his name? Reb Pinchas Teitz. So Rav Teitz, the son-in-law of Rav Yossi Blau, is the mashgiach in the yeshiva. So he was he was not a religious Zionist. He spoke about Eretz Yisrael. It was all of this was conducted in Yiddish. So I'm just mentioning connection about Reines, that we heard of that in the class. So going on, so briefly to sum up some of the biographical twists and turns of the life of Rav Reines, he studied in the Volozhin Yeshiva, which was the yeshiva in Lithuania, which most of the great rabbonim, if you wanted to know ordinarily speaking, where the rabbonim of Lithuania came from, and from the 19th century, practically all of them studied in the Volozhin Yeshiva. The other yeshivas were not on that particular caliber. There were other yeshivas. Until the yeshiva closed by order of the Russian government in 1893, when the Netziv, Natoli Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the Rosh Yeshiva. He was a Chayvav Tzion. He was someone that encouraged building Eretz Yisrael, but not into any type of movement, shape, or form. Rav Reines studied there, Volozhin Yeshiva, was in the Shtetl Shukyan, which is mentioned, and once later he had almost radical ideas. Why do we say radical? They were unusual ideas. He looked like the typical European Rav. If you've ever seen pictures of him, you see a patriarchal figure, a man that wears a kapota, and he has a large beard, and he has a personality, extraordinary. That's what he looked like. He was a typical Lithuanian Rav, besides being extraordinary Talmudic master. So once at a conference in Petersburg, in St. Petersburg, on the time of the Russian Tsar, in that 19th century, he suggested, in the presence of some of the great rabbonim that were there, who were some of the rabbonim? The father of Chaim Soloveitchik was there, Reb Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the Baal Beis HaLevi, and there was the Netziv was there from Volozhin, and there was a famous Rav of Lodz, Reb Eliyahu Chaim Meisels Zal. So what did he suggest? That we should introduce into yeshiva some secular learning. That's what he wanted to say. And we'll see later what he meant by secular learning. Like we say today, secular learning, we're thinking of physics, chemistry, philosophy, history, social sciences, and so forth, the whole array of a college curriculum. We'll see later what it meant by that. And they turned it down. He said, we'll not support that. So when he went back to his shtetl, he tried to do it there. And he was not successful. He couldn't raise funds or enough to attract people to come to that kind of a yeshiva. But that's not the end of that history, as we'll see later. Later he moved to a larger town called Švincian that was in Lithuania. And finally, in the 18, I would say in the late 1880s, became the Rav of a larger community near Vilna, Lida, spelled Lamed Yud Dalet Aleph. He was known after that as the Lida Rav. In fact, I have a late brother-in-law, Rav Savitsky Zal, came from that city, and he was called Reb Motel Lida. You know, there was called the person after the town where he came. So he was called the Lida Rav. He became involved in the movement of Zionists. That time, Theodor Herzl, all of us shalom, became politically active. He created the concept of a political Zionism. And what motivated that man is almost legendary in itself, because he came from a totally assimilated Hungarian family from Budapest. In fact, there was even talk that he might even convert to another religion. But somehow, when he was a newspaper reporter and later an editor in Vienna of the Wiener Neue Presse, of the new, the newspaper. And they say that what precipitated a lot, he attended the defamation and the Dreyfus situation in Paris, when Alfred Dreyfus, who was an officer from the French general staff, was accused, because he was a Zhuif, he was a Jew, of stealing secrets from one of the artillery of the French, who had developed the French 75 gun or so forth. And it was a plot. They wanted to find a scapegoat. He was not the one that did it. It's a famous story. Whole France became in an uproar. You saw where all the anti-Semitism came out. There were people that were in favor of Dreyfus. This is in the 1890s. So that's when Herzl was a newspaper reporter, attended when they publicly removed his uniform and he was sent to Devil's Island. And that's the famous story with Emil Zola, and the whole French general staff was under pressure until they finally exonerated him, and there was somebody else, an Austrian count, that was on the French general staff that was the traitor, not Dreyfus. But it said that precipitated Herzl to seeing the anti-Semites as if to say Jews don't have a place in the world as much as they seem to be successful. So he started the political movement of Zionism and so forth, and there were these congresses in Basel, which you have to read the history of Zionism about it. One year after, in the 1890s, the first Zionist Congress, the second and the third. So at that time, the delegates that attended were from all over Europe. A very large delegation came from Tsarist Russia to participate in this conference. They came to Switzerland, in Basel, Switzerland. But Rav Reines also attended. And at that time, he was concerned, as many of the other delegates that came from the religious areas, especially of Poland and Russia, which is under Tsarist rule, that these other Zionists were very secular. They were non-observant. The people there that were Mechalei Shabbos, they were almost so acculturated, you couldn't distinguish them from, let's say, a French citizen or a German citizen. A lot of them didn't believe in Hashem, but they did. They somehow came together to find a Jewish national home. That was the dream of Herzl. And Rav Reines came to one or two of those conferences, and he didn't get involved in direct contentious arguments or polemics with the others, but he was concerned of making sure, and that's when big arguments developed. If you read the history of those congresses, that they wanted to create a committee on culture, Kultur, use the German word, or in Yiddish, Kultur, Tarbut, we say in Ivrit. And with the Zionists from Eastern Europe said, what kind of culture? Culture is Torah and Mitzvahs. The religious, that's exactly what it was. I'm not going to be interrupted though. You have your hand up. You'll have to ask the questions later, I'm sorry. Anyhow, so this argument went on until later on. I'm just running very quickly some of the biographical backgrounds that Rav Reines, but because of his involvement already with the Zionists was looked upon as someone that you couldn't associate too much as far as the general rabbinic community was concerned. He was considered very much a persona non grata. He's getting together with the non-Frum people, with the Zionism, and as I said before, just like Reb Chaim Brisker was against Zionism, so are many of the other Rabbanim. They would not let people speak on behalf of Zionism, many of the communities. It was an uproar, especially. He suffered from that greatly. One of the terrible experiences, which was told to me originally by my father, though I think he might have been present there, when he wanted to arouse the feeling of people to join in a movement to create colonies and return to Eretz Yisrael, which is the purpose of religious Zionism, and say that's the main thing, to build a Jewish country that will be Jewish. You know, there's a lack of translation. When Herzl's book, the Judenstaat, if you translate it in English, they translate it as the Jewish state. That's wrong. It's not that he didn't mean a Jewish state. He meant a Stadt für Juden, a place where Jews could come, but the state necessarily didn't have to be Jewish, a Jewish thing. So that's what a lot of the political Zionists believed in. Some still believe today. It doesn't have to be politically Jewish. It's a place where Jews can find refuge, build their own country, and have the so-called natural culture or whatever it is, devoid of religious elements or belief in Hashem. So what happened once when Rav Zionist used to travel in the different cities, he came to the city of famous Litvish city of Kovna. Kovna, that was in the time of Tsarist Russia. Kovna was a center of Jewish activity, of great yeshivas. Slobodka Yeshiva, there are two Slobodka Yeshivas, the Musa Yeshiva, Knesset Yisrael, the other one Knesset Beis Yitzhak, the lot of B'nai Torah, and Rabbanim, Lomdim, and Kovna. That was at the time, that was after the passing of Reb Yitzhak Ohanan. His son, Reb Tzvi Hirsch, was the Rav then in Kovna. Anyhow, he came there to speak in one of the largest shulin, the Beis Medrash. So the Zionist group that was there had invited him, and others who heard about, they were anti-Zionistic, so when he tried to get into the shul, there was a big crowd. Some pushed against it and some pulled him. He was literally carried up. Remember, he's already not a youngster. This is about 1900 when this took place. He's literally carried up to the bima where he's going to give a drasha. So when he's carried up to the bima by some very strong young fellows who were very pro-Zionist, they got up on the bima, pushed up there someone that was called Reb Zelig Masmid. This scene is described quite clearly by the famous rabbinic decisor and author Reb Yechiel Yankov Weinberg Zal in one of his monographs at the end of his tshuvas, the Seredei Eish. So what happened is that this Reb Zelig was pushing against a fellow who was a tug of war. Who was in the middle of the tug of war? The Rav Einersal, this old Rav, and this Reb Zelig Masmid, who was very anti-Zionist, whispered something in his ear, which later they said. He said, "You leader Rav, to toss the tum sotom mit di bapikursim. Don't have anything to do with the unbelievers," because that they categorized all Zionists as being denying Hashem and Torah and mitzvahs. So as the tug of war happened, they pulled on the kapota, on the garment of Avinus, and it was torn. It was the way he describes it, kapota kahua, a tzerissin a kapota. I heard this story first about 60 years ago, but here I found it written up as to who did that. And the story is that Avinus kept that kapota, and he said, "After 120 years, it should be buried with me. It's a sign of what I sacrificed on behalf of Eretz Yisrael, the Jewish people." But others take it as a symbolic thing. Just like there was a tear in the kapata, it was a tear in the mind, in the soul of this rabbinic master that suffered that this terrible indignity. This is what happened. So we should know that in the 1890s, he received an offer from the Russian Jewish immigrant community of England, especially in Manchester, England, to become the Rav Rashi of all Russian Jewish immigrants in England, which were coming in great numbers, mostly from the Lithuanian and Tsarist Russia. Most of them came to escape the forced draft from the Russian army and so forth. That's how the Russian Jewish community built up in England, especially Manchester. So he went there, he traveled there, he spent a week and he refused to accept it. He came back to the city of Lida. And in 1902, he established officially the Mizrahi. And there was a large convention in Vilna. That's when it was founded, and it was decided they would not completely be separated from the general Zionist group, but in order to have some influence on the progress and the movement forward of Zionism, Mizrahi should be connected, but they should push for increased amount of Torah and mitzvahs, of learning, everything having to do with leading a total Jewish religious life. The only thing that Rav Reines got involved in that was very politically explosive, and this is not the place to discuss it. Remember, Herzl, at one time in the Zionist Congress, said when England made an offer of Uganda, that large territory in Eastern Africa, which is literally unsettled, he said that could be a place for Jews to find refuge. They could build a Jewish community there without interference. All they had was a couple of black tribes of natives or whoever it was, and there was a big argument about that. So Rav Reines took the side of Herzl, not because he disliked Eretz Yisrael. He was a practical person. Because there, in order to get into Eretz Yisrael, they had to get over the business with the Turks, with the Ottoman Empire. Here was an offer of temporary refuge where Jews, he had compassion because of the terrible economic situation and the persecution of Jews in Russia. All these pogroms and restrictions and discrimination, a Pale of Settlement, where Jews were forced to live in a certain particular place. So he founded a Mizrahi, and they concentrated on building Eretz Yisrael. They dropped the whole Uganda situation, and it gained a great deal of momentum for many Rabbonim, who also were in other places, joined in to assist and to be a spokespeople for that. Now, his main thing that was known for later in 1904, he established a yeshiva, which he had tried before, a yeshiva that would have some secular studies. So what do you think the secular studies were? Robert Berlin, who has the description of this in his Yiddish work, from Volozhin Biz Yerushalayim, he said, what do you think he had there? What was the secular department? He said, the secular department first is, they call this the Mada, Tanakh. And all the yeshivas, gedolos of Lithuania, they did not study Tanakh. They studied Talmud, the Gelel Gemara. You had a first Seder, a second Seder, you learned all night, whatever it was. Whether it was Volozhin, Mir, Telz, all the other yeshivas that were there, they didn't have any what say, shiurim or classes in Tanakh. So he says, Tanakh. Then also a little bit of digduk, Hebrew grammar, which meant studying the Hebrew language, and Oichad Abyssal Russisch to learn to speak Russian. That's because normally the Jews that lived in Tsarist Russia were self-contained in the shtetl. They only spoke Yiddish. Very few really could speak Russian very well. There's a famous story that was repeated. I have to repeat it to show that lack of understanding, that during the time of the beginning of a Russian revolution in 1904, 1905, when Russia was engaged in war against Japan, and it was up, there was turmoil in Russia, labor movements to get rid, to have more democracy against the czarist autocratic government, and so forth, and everybody was suspect of being a revolutionary. The story is told, I heard this from one of the teachers in Yeshiva, Dr. Norson Klotz, who was a teacher of Tanakh and Ivrit. He originally came from Slutsk, from Belarus, and he had been in Slobodka Yeshiva a while. He says, during that time, some of the Slobodka young men went out on a street, and they were in a group, and the Russian police arrested them. They couldn't explain to them, they couldn't speak Russian. And that took a long time to have them released, because they couldn't explain that they were not revolutionaries. They're congregated like on the street. They must be young fellows looking for trouble. So they were arrested. So when they came to the Mashgiach of Slobodka, Reb Nosson here, not to Hirsch Finkel, and they said, how come we come to that Nitoizgelet, they don't know how to speak Russian? So his answer, this was his classic answer, as a hund built, that was Eisleilen Bilden, if a dog barks, do you have to learn how to bark? That was his response. So that was the attitude even against learning the language of the land. So what was the yeshiva of Reines had all the, in matters of Talmudic learning that we would say is an intensive yeshiva today, and they learned Tanakh and Digduk and the language of the country. Now, who did he have as one of the famous Rosh Yeshiva was a world-class Ilui, a prodigy, who later came to America, who was a Rosh Yeshiva and died a fairly young man. That was the Maitre d'Ilui, Reb Shlema Palyachek Zal, who, as a young boy about bar mitzvah, amazed Reb Chaim Briske with his gigantic intellect and knowledge of Gemara. He had a great mind. That Reb Chaim called him his Liebling. He's such an Ilui. He's so astonished at this young fellow's knowledge. But what happened is Reb Shlema Palyachek became a religious Zionist, and he taught in the Lieder Yeshiva. He taught there at that yeshiva. Now, what do you think the name of the yeshiva was? Torah Vadas. Now, why do I mention that? Because the yeshiva in Brooklyn, New York, which is called Torah Vadas, was founded in the earlier part of the 20th century, of course, in Brooklyn, by one of the great Zionist rabbonim in America, who was a rav in Williamsburg and later in Borough Park, and became world famous, Rav Wolf Gold Zal. Rav Wolf Gold, whom I remember used to come to the yeshiva to hear some of the shiurim of Soloveitchik, who later spoke there, he named the name just like the name of the leader yeshiva. But if you would ask the people in Brooklyn, because that's not a Zionist yeshiva, by no means, shape, or form, but he was one. He went from door to door to get people to register their children to start that yeshiva in the Williamsburg area of Brooklyn. He was a rav there. He was a, because he was interested in thorough Torah education, which was a chiddush in the earlier part of the 20th century to have day schools or yeshiva. That's why it's called Torah Vadas after that, after the leader yeshiva, and so forth. But that's something that many people don't know. Now, Rav Reines again continued to travel, to speak, and so forth, and he passed away during the First World War in 1915. And he left a great amount of manuscripts, but in his lifetime, he published many sforim about Zionism. He published Shilas and Tshuvas, Responsa. He published for him that dealt with methodology. This was a radical change in approach of analytic understanding of Shas, of Talmud. He used a certain elements of analyzing things from a standpoint of the rules of logic, a sefer called Chesem Tochtis. He had many sforim, and many things were left over in manuscript. Now, from a far as his own understanding what he was doing, of Meir Berlin, who's met him and spoke to him many times, Rav Reines once told him the following thing. Remember, Rav Reines was a great darshan, great speaker. And he introduced a method of drush that was not very familiar to many of the Jews there in Eastern Europe, because ordinarily a rav was not called on to be a darshan. He gave it, you know, two drushes a year, Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Tshuva. The old joke used to be that an old rav said to a young rav, he's starting out in the rabbinate, he says, you have to memorize 14 drushes. Why 14? Two drushes a year over 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, you repeat the drushes because they'll forget what you said in the first 7 years. That's all they had to do. The rav did not speak every Shabbos. Who spoke? Itinerant Magidim. Preachers that came from city to city, or maybe some city hired what they call a Stottmagid, a city preacher. That was a more well-to-do community. So Rav Reines said to Rav Berlin, he said, I'll teach the world two things, wie zu lernen und wie zu sagen. Sagen in the literature Yiddish means preaching, sermonizing. So he said, to teach how to learn that what the world didn't accept. He said many people followed his method of drush and so forth. In fact, in some of the talks that are recorded from Rav Soloveitchik Zal, one of my great teachers, the Masmichim, here and there he makes a note, I am indebted to this idea to Rav Reines, or so forth. He mentions, because he was able to interpret what we, you know, what we would call in the homiletic expansion, in symbolic interpretation of certain texts. And let me give you an example. Now here is one of the Sforim of Rav Reines. This Sefer was published in 1926 by his son. His son was Moshe Mordechai Reines, and who also was a fine Talmud Chacham. But he got some of the manuscripts, and it's called Sefer HaErechim, which means a book of values or so forth, where he has from Aleph to Chof, the letter Chof, he has their topics, and he discusses different topics. So I'm just going to mention a few ways, the way he analyzed things in order to conclude, to show his way of drush. And one that I heard that was sent to me by a rav who visited me at a certain time. Let me mention that was the first time I heard about a drasha from Rav Reines. Unfortunately, years ago when I was sitting shiva for my father, Zecheinu Levracha, going back to 1949, I had a visit from a prestigious rav whom I know, who was a teacher of my late brother, and he mentioned to me a sort of consoling. This was talking to an Ovel. The Gemara says, and this is the interpretation that he brought from Rav Reines, and you see how Rav Reines takes a symbolism and he changes the literal meaning of the text to include an idea. The Gemara says in Moed Kotna, Daf Chav Zayin, Omid Beis, call him Iskasha al Mes, Yosem Idai, al Mes Acher Hu Beicher. Whoever is so overwhelmed by the loss that is incurred of losing somebody, and he can't come to terms with the loss, he will weep for the loss of somebody else. It's almost like a curse. In other words, you're not letting go, so you want to, as if to say, you want to be an ovel, you're going to be an ovel on something else. You have to say there's a beginning and there's an end of avelus, though difficult as it sounds. So how did Rav, so al mes achar hu vavei, he weeps over another mess. So Rav Reines said, they've a different pshat. It says, the pshat is this, that we all believe, that's basic to Jewish belief, there's an olam haba, that the end of the physical life is not the end of the soul. The soul goes to another place. There's an olam haba, we all talk about that. Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek olam haba, there's an olam haba, another world, another soul, or so forth. But if a person weeps so much about the loss of the physical loss, it seems to show he doesn't believe that there's another world, or so forth. that it can't be, it's not existing. Al mes achar, he's saying that other world is dead. That's wrong. That was Rabbi Einus's nuance. That's the first time I heard that nuance, and that's an interesting drush. It's sort of a revolutionary way of explaining al mes achar, something else that's dead. Now here in the Sefer Erech, I'm going to give you another example where he has under the bays, it says he has the word Ben Sion. So why does he mention that, Ben Sion? Because in the works of the 18th century Pesach, the Chidor, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azeloi Zal, who was the great Sephardic rabbinic master, everybody knows the Sephardim of the Chidor, the Birke Yosef on Yerodea, so many other Sephardim that the Chidor wrote on Tanakh, on all areas of Torah, on Kabbalah, on Machshava, you name it, Drush. So the Chidor says the name Ben Sion is given to a child that parents who had difficulty in having children that remained alive after they were born, when a child was born, they gave it the name Ben Sion. And that's supposed to give a segula, a measure of Arichas Yomim. The child will survive. So that's what he said, the Chidor writes, I saw that in a Yerushalmi. Tom Yerushalmi. So Rabbi Einus, in commenting on that, said, in the Yerushalmis that we don't have such a source. I mean, he could say it. He was a Bucky in Babylon Yerushalmi. We don't have such a source. So what is the significance? Here's how he interpreted it. He mentions a Medrash in Breishis Rabbah. The Medrash says at the beginning, the Torah said, Yerev Ayavaker Yom Echot. Vayehi Erev, Breishis Rabbah says, Elu HaRoshoyim. That's a symbol of the wicked, darkness. Vayivaker, Elu HaTzadikim. Those are the righteous. Yom Echot, what is that one day? Yom HaKippurim. It's Yom Kippur. So how does Rabbi Einus interpret that? He says, he interprets this as bringing together a day when Jews of all sorts come together. The Roshoyim come to Shul, all types of people. We say that Onam Atir and Lispalonim Avayonim. We at start out called Nidre, allowing everybody to be part of the congregation. Those who've been so far away, but they're coming back. They might be wicked or so forth, but Yom Kippur brings them all together. So what does it have to do with Ben Sion? So this is where he makes, so to speak, the pitch for Zionism. People, the Zionist movement, awakened a lot of assimilated Jews, not in a religious matter, but it awakened them to the idea that they are part of a Jewish people. Just like Yom Kippur brings Jews together that might all year night have gone to shul, but they come together. And that element of Ben Sion is a segula for the Jewish people to become closer to Hashem, come closer to observe Torah and mitzvahs, and that's why it's a segula for survival. That's how he mentions that particular thing in a religious matter. That is his drush, how he discusses that. In another place, he talks about, and with this example I'll conclude, he talks about the regesh hakavod, of honor. What is kavod? We talk about honor. So he speaks in this terms, in realistic terms. What was the kavod of the Jewish people in Tsarist Russia, for example? There was no real kavod. Jews were persecuted, discriminated, they couldn't go into certain professions, they couldn't go beyond a certain city. They had to have certain passes. I mean, I'll just give you an example. My late father-in-law, when he got smicha and he got married, he went to a town near Bialystok called Bielovizh, which was near a great forest, a game preserve for the hunting for the Tsar. So, but he was in that, no Jews were really allowed to be in Bielovizh or so forth, unless you had a special kind of pass that allowed you to be there. They called it in Russian the pervagilda, whatever that meant. You were a member of a guild or something. But he was a rov. So he went there actually almost illegally. He was officially a bookbinder, whatever it was. But what happened in the middle of the night, it seemed that the police, the Tsarist police, found out that he was there. They drove them out of the town. They had to get out. They couldn't live there. It was forbidden. This is what Jews suffered. They had no cover. What kind of profession could a Jew have, or so forth, unless he made $1 million with some sort of a contract, you know, through some type of manufacturing. But otherwise, Jews had all the what was called the menial trades: a shuster, a schneider, a cobbler, a tailor, a balagola, whatever they did there. There was or petty tradesmen. Everything was restricted, and because they wanted to keep no covet for Jews. This is the way Avraham is explaining that. Where did Jews have covet? When they went into the shul, they had big arguments about covet. Who's going to get shlishi? Who's going to get shishi? We have our covet. Those was our covet. At least we had that sense of covet all the time. He's saying, but ultimately when we'll have our own country and everything else, so we say in the davening, Uvechein tein kovod li'amecha. What does that mean? You say it Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Uvechein tein kovod. What do you mean by kovod? Kovod means that we have this sense of honor and autonomy to rise up around from our surroundings to be people that are of outstanding nature, respected, and so forth. You know that in the early days of America, when Jews came to the country, it was very hard for them to go in certain professions. Like you used to say, I know I was growing up, you used to say, where'd you have a Jew in the banking industry? Unless he made his own bank. But in the banks, you didn't find, in order to avoid the accusation of anti-Semitism, the president of the bank says, oh, we have Mr. Goldberg there in the bank. We have one Jew amongst hundreds or thousands of employees to show he's not anti-Semitic. They had quotas in the colleges. In Harvard, they established quotas. In all other universities, there was the what they called numerus clausus. You had a quota. And they were, of course, originally in Harvard, they said the Jews, when they were allowed in, they took over the whole law school because they all were trained in learning Gemara. They knew how to be good lawyers, judges, so they made the quotas. It's written up in the history of universities about that. Today, it's of course, you can't do that. But, chein tein kovod le'amecha, give kovod to your Jewish people, that they should have, you know, what the Jews became, some people became rich, they became junk peddlers. They had scrap yards. In Yiddish you say, Gaitaroma Shmata Latnik, he's collecting shmatas and things. And so but some Jews became very wealthy from, but such menial things or so. They used to go in the back alleys or in the streets. Remember in Philadelphia, there was a man that was like a junk peddler or was buying things. He walked around yelling in English, I'm buying old clothes. He walked right through the alleys in the back. I'm buying old clothes, you know, to get people gave him the old garments. He might take them to some place where they would turn it into something else, into paper, whatever it was. Menial things. So, v'sein kovod le'amecha, give kovod to your people that you should rise up and be people that have sense of pride, whatever you do, and that people shouldn't be able to look down on you. L'havdol elef havdolos, I mean, the Nazis, the Germans, Yimach Shemo, one of the first things they tried to do with Jews in concentration camps and extermination camps, to remove all sense of covet. They reduced people to numbers and treated them, you know, treat people like animals and so forth. So that sense of covet, when you have in the movement to have and Eretz Yisrael and so forth. Now, since the state was established, whatever we say about the state, but people are concerned that you have a government that can say its citizens, just like the American government says, he's a citizen, you have to protect him, and we're ready to protect him and to take action to anybody that tries to hurt him. And that's the way Israel has gained that sense of respect in spite of all the anti-Semitism. So that goes back to this idea of the same Kovod le'amecha that he explains here in the Sefer Erechin. So I just want to conclude, he just gave you a mini insight from the many works and Sforim and ideas of Rav Aina Zal remains a majestic figure in the history of Torah or religious Zionism because of his self-sacrifice of Avos Yisroel, his love for the Jewish people, Avos HaTorah, and Avos Eretz Yisroel. All these love joined together in this man that literally gave his life in order to found what we would call the Mizrahi. And that we can also say that may his memory be blessed, that we're able to remind ourselves that such a great person was the founder of the religious Zionist movement. Okay.
Question
or two?
Did he ever make Aliyah? Or
what?
Did he ever make Aliyah?
No, he did not. He did not. He passed away in the middle of the war. I don't think he ever visited Eretz Yisroel the way some others were able to do that. But he had the desire to do that, but it did not materialize. But the people that spoke to him, you know, there's a great Zionist preacher who has works of Yitzhak Nissenbaum, Zecheinu Levracha, whether you ever heard of him. He was also a Volozhin Talmud. He started out by being not only just a Talmud Chacham and a Magid Shir in the city of Minsk, he became the secretary of the founder of the Chovev Etzion movement, Reb Shmuel Moharivar, in Bialystok. So he knew Reina, so he has an autobiography in Ivrit. It's called Alei Cheldi, The Leaves of My World. He describes his life, but he describes all the personalities that he met, the rabbinic personalities from the 1890s up until the 1920s. Unfortunately, he was murdered in the Holocaust. His last position was in a famous shul in Varsha, the Tlomatsky Gas Shul. If you ever see a picture of Warsaw during the German bombing, they show a shul burning. That was the shul of Yitzhak Nissenbaum, was the Rav. And who was the Chazan there that got out in time? With Moshe Kusevitsky, all of a sudden. Famous Chazan of Kusevitsky was that Chazan in that shul. So Nissenbaum describes his meetings also with Reines, how he spoke with him. But he refers to him always as Hagon. The other Rabbonim that he meets, he doesn't refer to that. He says this was a different person altogether. You know, face-to-face meetings, when you see the type of conversations that he had with him and so forth.